We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Craig is usually a fan of water cooler talk, but it's draft season, and that's all anyone wants to talk about. The Athletic has loads of articles about this year's draft. But Greg doesn't have The Athletic, so now he's filling up his water bottle in the bathroom sink. Which, to remind you, is the sink people use after they use the bathroom. Get The Athletic and get the info you need to speak draft fluently.
College football is a game of sights.
All the band is out on the field!
And sounds.
Caught by Westbrook for a touchdown!
From screaming fans to marching bands, it's the raucous atmosphere that sets college football apart from everything else, except during a pandemic. Last fall, media partners and broadcasters were forced to adapt on the fly to unprecedented circumstances. This is how they made it work. From the Solid Verbal, this is a special production. So, now what? Welcome back. My name is Ty Hildenbrandt. Joining me, as always, over there in Chicago, the one and only Dan Rubenstein. Sir, how you doing?
I'm good. I'm licking my proverbial chops. I don't know if that's too evocative over this episode, because we have done already a couple of episodes looking at the 2020 season and the 2020 year from a college football perspective as a whole. And this episode is all about how you and I, and I think a majority of people, consumed the 2020 season. Obviously, a lot of people went to games, but not nearly as many as normally do, and not nearly as many people socialized in the way that they normally do around college football. So this is an episode that I think we are going to dedicate to the broadcast and fan, the home fan experience, and how different it was in 2020, and hopefully how it will never happen again, but just sort of debriefing on what it was like consuming college football only as a TV product, which I know you and I did. I know a lot of people also went to games, once again, but it was more than it ever was a TV product. So debriefing essentially that product itself.
What amazed me the most in watching from home last year was how much, for the most part, it felt the same. There were a lot of elements, as we'll find out here shortly, that needed to be made up on the fly.
Mm-hmm.
They were very much shooting from the hip, be it ESPN or CBS or anybody broadcasting a game. But I think for the home viewer, by and large, the product mostly felt the same.
Yeah. Yes and no for me, just because I didn't watch it with anybody. My wife feigned interest at times during Michigan games that we watched a little bit of, because that's where she went. But even it was not a fun year to watch Michigan football for Michigan fans. And there was just, you know, the lack of electricity watching the TV product. Even when stadiums were empty and they piped in sound, it didn't feel the same. There would be those big wide shots after a touchdown and you wouldn't see anybody or nearly anybody, depending on the conference you were watching, in the stands. I think there was a certain amount of energy that was extremely hard to replicate that. I'm sure broadcasters and broadcast teams and networks tried to do their very best, but it was very different for me. But also my personal life was very different in moving around the country and such. So maybe my experience was unique, but it was different to me.
It definitely was different. It was still good to have the product on TV and to help us unpack a little bit more about what that was like. We brought on Anish Shroff from ESPN, a broadcaster, has called college football games for a good long time now. Anish, longtime friend of the show. We asked him, what were your thoughts when all hell was breaking loose in March, taking the longer view on what it could mean for a college football season?
I had as busy of a month as I can remember in March of 2020. And I remember when I got done, I had done three games in three cities on three consecutive nights. And I felt, wow, March is just getting started. And then the next week, everything goes away. Everything shuts down. Realistically, at the time, I felt kind of how I think a lot of people felt. Okay, there's no way this is going to stretch into the fall, right? I thought we would be okay or close to okay. And then as the news kept on trickling in, and every week would go by and things got worse and worse, you're like, oh man, are we going to have a season?
That rings so true. I remember doing our live streams and we were in the very beginning alarmed, as we all were, alarmed that this could have some impact, not just on society, but on the sport we know and love. And then, as the summer wore on, as we got closer to the season, as we detailed in our first episode of So Now What, when we talked through the Big Ten decision making, it became very apparent that this was going to be a different kind of year. I'd imagine if you're a broadcaster, this being your livelihood and all, it's rather concerning. We asked Anish, what were your thoughts as we got a little bit deeper into this thing? And it became apparent that, you might not be able to go to games. You actually might have to call them from, say, a remote studio somewhere in Charlotte.
And I had done some games remotely from studio, but football is a different animal altogether. There's so many moving parts, so many things to see. And all of a sudden it was, this will be challenging. This is going to be a piece of the puzzle. And then you're sort of formulating a game plan. What do you need to see? Where are your eyes going? Will we have cameras for this? Who's going to be our liaison on site? And it really became this collaborative process on essentially trying to put together a jigsaw puzzle.
I did not know until just this past year that they could pull this off.
In terms of remote broadcasts, having the play-by-play and analyst in a studio in Charlotte or Connecticut or Los Angeles or something?
Not to this extent. I had visited the Big Ten studios, Big Ten Network studios at some point, and I saw the closet where they, I guess, would do remote broadcasts of other events. But in none of those cases was it ever something as robust as a football broadcast, where you've got so many different moving pieces, so much to account for, different camera angles, what have you. When it became apparent that this is a direction they were headed, my ears perked up. I'm not in the broadcasting business to the same extent Anish is, but I was wondering at that point, how the hell are they going to pull this off?
Same. And I knew that football had been called remotely, but those remote broadcasts, from what I know, are the quote unquote smaller games, fewer cameras, fewer graphics, fewer replays, stuff like that. So there was not a huge need to have a big, robust remote situation. But the thing is with the networks, they had the lead up time. This wasn't something that snuck up on them. So they were able to get their ducks in a row for weeks, months, whatever, to say, okay, this is how we're going to operate with this. This is how we're going to operate with that. This is how we're going to do this remotely. So they were at least able to plan for a different kind of broadcast year. So it would feel normal to idiots like you and me. And so I think I noticed certain elements. Obviously, it's hard not to notice the announcers not reacting to things happening with crowd energy in the same way. That's easy to see that, like, okay, this is a little bit different. When you're calling a Boston College game and it's just a bunch of cardboard cutouts, it's hard to sort of match the energy of the moment. but largely technologically, you know, graphics would come in, replays would come in. There were different camera angles, and maybe there were fewer games where you had the zip line cam, whatever that's called. But I don't know if I fully noticed it. So I by and large thought, you know, ESPN, CBS, Fox, the regional networks, the conference networks did as good a job as expected. So I came away very impressed because essentially, Ty, they're you and me, right? They're better versions, but they're at home or they're in a studio just podcasting games live. That's what it kind of is.
I didn't really notice the small details.
Right.
That might have been off with a broadcast. Obviously, you look out in the stands, there are no people there, yet you hear crowd noise, which we will talk about momentarily.
Right.
You know that that's fabricated. And you can sense that maybe announcers are a bit disconnected from the moment. But a lot of the little stuff, I thought they did a pretty good job of papering over. And that's a credit to everybody involved in these productions. You know, you talk to somebody like Anish, again, whose livelihood is broadcasting games, and you don't necessarily have a level of understanding of the nuance that goes into it. These guys take it very seriously. Every little inch of the football field, they're trying to get a description of what's going on out there. Little things like context that you might be able to pick up before a game.
It's just different. You know, there's something about game day at a stadium. There's something about that game day environment. One of the things that I usually like to do when I get there, just survey my surroundings. What do you see? What do you pick up using your eyes and ears to ask questions? You don't get that anymore. You're at the mercy in a lot of ways of the school providing you with information. And as we all know, schools will provide information to make them look as good as possible.
And even little things like building rapport with the broadcasting team.
Just being on the road with your colleagues and going out the night before the game and grabbing dinner, having a glass of wine, just building chemistry and camaraderie. You just don't have that. Everybody's masked up. We are all socially distant. They're very careful about where you can sit and how far you can stand.
Now, in Anish's case, he broadcasted games remotely from a studio in Charlotte. And thankfully, Tom Luganbill was in the same studio as him. So at least he had some rapport, being so he had his announcing partner physically there with him. You and I can speak a lot to what it's like when your co-host is not with you.
Correct.
It has taken us the better part of a decade to build up this rapport. So you can imagine, especially going into a new football season, sometimes teams are mixed and matched on the broadcasting front, to try and build up that level of understanding with your co-host so quickly. In a new setting, everything is completely new. There are new inputs, new outputs. I again, am really surprised and quite impressed that it all went as well as it did.
Yeah, and it's not just the on-air people, right? It's the people that are spotting who's tackling who or who's substituting in for whom. There's the producer in the broadcaster's ear, and you know, certain broadcasters work better with certain producers. They understand what they like. They understand, like, okay, this is when I like the replays coming in. This is how quickly I want to see the replays in a separate display or whatever. I think there's a lot of nuance behind the scenes that, and even in times when things are quote unquote normal, we all remember those games where all of a sudden there is no wide cam available because it's foggy and we need only the cameras on the field, or all the cameras go out except for one main one. The one main one's trying to track all the action, and that's normal times. And so in terms of communication behind the scenes, it is that element of, you know, the duck looks calm and serene above the surface, but underneath it's paddling like all hell. And so I think there was more of an element this fall than ever before, and the better broadcast just masked everything a lot better. But no, it was fascinating to hear him talk about the different elements that needed to come together just so.
How do you overcompensate for the situation, not having the crowd noise, not being there on site?
You're trained, depending on where you're calling the game, if you're at a Clemson or an LSU or Virginia Tech, one of these raucous environments, a lot of times the best thing you can do on third and one is shut the hell up. and just let that crowd roar, especially if it's the defense looking for a stand or whatever. You just let the crowd go, and the crowd becomes that extra person in the broadcast. And that amplifies the moment more than anything that you can say. Well, that's not there now. And you always worry about over-talking and saying too much. And in some of these cases, when you scale it back a little bit, all of a sudden it's a sound of silence, right? Where is everybody? And you almost feel, all right, do I need to jump in a little bit? So you almost have to recalibrate your process a little bit.
Recalibrate the process, Dan. One of the questions that you had for Anish that I get the sense you were very excited to ask was about the crowd noise, right?
Yeah. The fake crowd noise.
The fake crowd noise. What were your thoughts on fake crowd noise this year, Dan?
It was very strange. And it was strange because I found myself getting comfortable with how normal the broadcast would feel in those games in which maybe it was only friends and family, maybe it was a few thousand, a few hundred, or no fans at all. The one game that specifically stood out to me that I really was able to connect to the fact that there were no humans watching the game. I'm almost positive this is true. Michigan State in the Big House, which is, of course, already in a cavernous place defined by how large and overwhelming it can be. Michigan State has the upset, and there would be a number of wide shots that were supposed to, I don't know, add environmental character to the situation. And there was a feeling of these players snuck onto the field on a Wednesday morning to play a game. I'm almost positive there's a tradition, like the student newspapers, the Michigan and Michigan State student newspapers, they play the night before. And it had that feel to it where it was, why don't we just all throw, like, as a pop-up? It's a pop-up game. Why don't we just, I don't know, why don't we mess around on a Saturday morning and play some college football? Let's just do it. Let's go crazy and do it. So that stood out to me when I would hear the crowd noise followed up by shots of no humans. My brain almost felt like it was getting tricks played on it. It was very strange.
I get the sense that Anish was in a very similar spot. First and foremost, we asked him, where'd the crowd noise come from?
Well, as far as I know, for the games that I did, most of the fake crowd noise was being pumped in by the schools themselves. So it was the PA at the school that would be in charge of that.
So the schools are pumping it in, which is an important bit of context. We also asked him, like, was it helpful to you to hear this noise at all, or what was your take on it?
From my standpoint, it was helpful not being there, because if you are there and it's okay, we're looking around and I see 200 people in the seats or nobody, and you're rocking all this crowd noise, come on, who are you fooling? But not physically being there, it actually gives you this fake sense of, hey, something is happening and something is important, and it props up your energy by proxy.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
So the crowd noise helped him more being offsite than it would have if he were there.
Can I tell you something? I have no reason to doubt Anish. Okay? He would know better than you or I would. But I have been in the Fox truck, the A-team Fox truck, NFL Fox, not college Fox. So this is like the team that would do a Super Bowl or a, you know, an NFC championship game, the biggest of the big crew, the Aikman Joe Buck crew. And this was for a documentary thing I worked on a few years ago. And I got to watch the audio mixer do his thing mid-game, a huge game. It was Patriots Saints, I believe, in Foxborough. And he had a mixer with, like, I don't know, 64 channels, 32 channels, some crazy number of audio channels. And I got to watch him as a player was carted off, move the button up, the lever up for the sad Fox theme, the ba-da-dun, da-da-dun, 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 right, into commercial. So I know the pure raw power that television has from an audio perspective. And it is still hard for me to believe that a version of that guy didn't exist in Bristol or in LA to sort of level out the environment as the game was going on, because I do know the raw audio power available to these networks. So no reason not to believe Anish, but at the same time, it doesn't fully make sense that networks would give that much control over the TV broadcast audio to the random stadium audio engineer. I don't know.
And I think it was different depending on the sport. I know back in the fall, if you watched any like Premier League soccer, you could watch one channel that had the crowd noise and another that
really
didn't. Yeah, they would allow that. You to watch a different station that didn't have it, maybe online or through one of the pay services. So just a really weird, again, layer of context that some of the networks tried to add in to make the product feel a little bit more authentic.
You're the audio junkie between us. You are the person who pays attention to things like that, whether it's in audio form or the audio during a TV show or whatever. Where were your ears and brain connected watching these games? Were you just accepting this fake noise as like, yep, okay, this is all, I've accepted it and I'm not paying attention to it? Or were you paying closer attention as you were watching a game in a bigger moment, knowing, like, I don't know which game it was. I think Notre Dame was at Boston College, right? So you at least had one Notre Dame game where there were zero people in the crowd. Did that take you out of anything? Were you paying extra close attention to how the audio engineer was riding the levels? Was that something you paid attention to?
Riding the levels, sure. I tend to pay attention to the volumes of the two commentators. It's really easy for those volumes to get a little bit out of sync and to feel a bit disconnected from the game, especially when someone's doing a broadcast remotely like that. And there were a few instances where you heard it, but by the end of the year, they got really good at it. They got really good at mixing everything down.
You're talking about with the fake crowd noise you're talking about
with the crowd noise, with the other microphones that maybe they had on site, the whistle, the sound of the players hitting each other, things like that. It was really easy, I think, in the beginning for some of the voices of the commentators to be a little bit too loud, or one to be too loud and the other to be a little bit too soft. And by the end, they got really good at doing it.
I noticed I was able to hear whistles and yelling from the sideline onto the field early on in the season. I couldn't tell you a specific game, but like when an offensive coordinator was trying to get the attention of his quarterback, or when there were substitutions being made and somebody was yelling for a linebacker to run off the field, I did notice that I was hearing those more than I normally would, which makes sense. Obviously, there's less sound to interrupt everything. But I think you're right that in the beginning of the season, there were audio instances that felt different.
We asked Anish, what was the remote studio setup like? If you sat down at your desk, what was in your field of view?
The peripherals would be, I'd be sitting on the right side of this extended broom closet, if you will. Luganville is to the far left. In front of me, I have a desktop computer. And on that desktop monitor, my stats guy, Paul Newman, would type in there and I would see what's going on. To the left of that, I had my monitor a little bit elevated. That was our program feed. That's the game itself. It's what the viewers are seeing on television. Right above that, they could give me one extra monitor, one extra camera. So I had the all 22. And then in that same monitor, I had the stats feed. Then I had a second monitor or a second laptop, which had net return, which is the feed on a delay. So sometimes it allows you to see a play twice. If you're in replay, it allows you to see the highlights when they do a cut in. So you're able to kind of watch that. Okay, you're showing Kyle Pitts here from Florida. We can react off of that. And then there was an ISO monitor, which is where our producer can show us things before they come on air, whether it's a graphic or an edit or a package. Hey, look in your ISO. Let me know when you want to go to this. It's all, you know, broadcast jargon, but there were a lot of inputs.
It sounds very complicated. It doesn't sound unlike some of the rigs that you and I have put together, obviously a lot more sophisticated.
Sure.
But it's very clear, the more we talk to Anish, how they were cobbling this thing together. Again, I think they all did a very admirable job of doing it, but a lot of it was shooting from the hip, trying to get the best information they could to the broadcasters. Like, one of the interesting things that Anish said was that he's not usually a phone guy, you know, a cell phone guy during the game, but you're trying to get as much information as you can in the moment. And so, whereas before, maybe he's tweeting and texting periodically throughout the course of a game, now he's tuned into his phone throughout the entire broadcast, using it to get whatever information maybe the school is putting out or someone on the ground is putting out.
If that particular game didn't have a sideline reporter, didn't have producers on the ground overhearing, seeing a player get carried off because of an injury, or whatever the circumstance, taken into the injury tent, whatever, that they're searching for information just like the rest of us. There's a certain helplessness, I'm sure, that comes from broadcasting a game remotely. And I can imagine looking at screens and trying to be an authority on what's happening 1,800 miles away. It feels inauthentic. It feels like you are figuratively reaching to appear to be in the know.
So Anish mentioned the all 22 camera, Dan.
Right. It's the coach's angle from way up high that they watch tape from. Yeah.
Interesting story on why that monitor ended up being one of the ones in front of him.
You may have had a camera guy have a COVID test, and so now you've got a backup camera guy. And that's the stuff people don't realize. And guess what? Play action pass, he's fooled and he's not following it. Well, now us as play-by-play guys and analysts, for the most part, we can only see what you see on TV. We had that early in the year and they said, hey, what if we had the all 22? So you have that on an extra monitor. And so that situation happened in a game and I can look up and I can see, okay, I'm off to the other monitor now. I can see that it was indeed a pass. He threw it downfield and the ball was intercepted or it was caught or whatever. And you can still call the play.
You have a lot of instances like this. The deeper we got into conversation with Anish, a bunch of instances where they tried something. Maybe it didn't not work, but through the course of their normal business, decided there were other things that they could do to further optimize. Another example, spotters. You know what a spotter is, right?
Yep.
Spotter's a guy who is keeping track of who's making plays, keeping track of key events in a game, feeding all that information back to the broadcasters.
We had a spotter who was on site and basically had a gizmo where he's got my spotting board. And when substitutions are coming in and out, he can point and say, hey, this guy's in, this guy's out, or update me on injuries.
Figuring out how to communicate with the remote staff. It's hard enough. You're in a studio somewhere in Charlotte, physically removed from the game, artificial crowd noise coming in through your headset, a bunch of monitors that you're not accustomed to in front of you, trying to paint a picture with your voice as to what is going on. All the while, you still got to communicate with others who are connected. I don't know if Anish said, maybe Skype, maybe phone, maybe Zoom, who knows? You are trying to collect all of these parts to put together a broadcast.
And then the other part of it too is, and he sort of touched on this, but when broadcasters aren't in the stadium and they're not in the town and they don't go out the night before, and it's not that they're going to get a pulse of whatever it is, Tennessee football or Missouri football or Cal football. They're not going to get that in, like, you know, they're parachuting in, they're in and out, but there is that element of feeling the energy in a town the night before, and the seeing the out of town fans, seeing, you know, the excitement for the game in the morning, and then traveling to the stadium and seeing people tailgating. It can't help but feel, the people broadcasting and producing the game, that they're part of something big, that it's building to a moment. Even if it's a game between, you know, two unranked teams, people are still so excited for football. It's not even just about the noise and energy in the stadium, because as we know, college football is a cultural thing, right? It's showing up at 6 a.m. to set up your tailgate. And so everybody involved in that broadcast sees that. They can sense the excitement. So they're wanting to take that excitement and put it into the game themselves. They feel the weight of the scale of that game. So it's something that, I mean, I'm not saying poor them, I'm saying more poor us, because we like it when a broadcaster is into it, that understands that even though Oregon or Notre Dame lost last week, we're still feeling good about this week. We're still feeling optimistic. We still can't wait to get loud in the stadium. And so it's impossible to me for anybody in a remote room, as good as their rapport is, to be able to bring that to their microphone. And so that to me is something that I noticed a little bit, but in hearing Anish talk, think, I don't know how you possibly fake it. It just seems impossible.
This was the one that got me when he talked about the statistician at home.
We had a statistician who was watching the games at home. Well, how could he communicate with us? So in the beginning, it was on a Zoom call and he'd have a chat box and he would type in the chat box. Well, the issue there is, what if I'm not looking at that chat box and I look at it three plays later and he's got something up there? Is that still relevant? So they came up with this other system where we're both on this website, we both log in, and it's almost like a whiteboard where he'll type in, and then once it's no longer relevant, he hits one button, it's gone, and he can type the next thing. So if I'm looking in there, whatever I see in there will be relevant.
Were they using Google Docs for this, Dan?
Isn't that how, gosh, who was, there was a general that was having some sort of inappropriate relationship, and that's how they were communicating, live Google Docs? I think so. I think that's the case. But I don't know if they were using Google Docs, but they're using something very similar to it.
It sounds like they were using something like Google Docs. And this is where it got real interesting for me, because, you know, so much of what we do, I'm not comparing what we do, but all these years has been very cobbled together with these tools that we could find on the internet. And I think desperate times called for desperate measures in this case, and ESPN and CBS and anybody broadcasting a game, be it via TV, radio, you name it, had to improvise and had to see what tools were at their disposal and basically use all of them until they got the formula right. Anish said openly, look, like,
you have to almost go in thinking, okay, there's certain things, if I miss, it's going to happen and I can't beat myself up over it.
You're never going to be perfect, but at least over the course of the season, it tended to get better at it. And I think by the end, honestly, it was a pretty close to normal product, albeit there weren't the normal number of people in the stands, the normal amount of fervor around a football game just because of COVID.
Yeah. If you remember, we talked to Adam Amin, who's now at Fox, last year. He called College Football Forever, and he talked about that ability, just in reference to the All 22 camera that was added, that when he or any broadcaster is in the booth, they could see Amari Cooper breaking loose deep. And so their voice could rise to match what they're seeing. And so I think the networks piecing together, I know certain networks had, you know, people in games and or in stadiums, and certain didn't, depending on the size of the game or the size of the broadcast. But it is that ability to on the fly say, okay, I need to add this display so I can see this, or we need this element to the spotting or the stat guy or the graphics or the replays or whatever. We like to be able to shuffle on the fly, I think is fascinating, because that's nothing you can do typically in the same way in the booth itself.
The operative question now as we move forward is how much of whatever new ground we broke in 2020 will be carried over into 2021.
What do you think?
I think they've found some ways that they can further optimize the broadcast. They certainly have figured out that they can do this if they have to. I don't think anybody wants to, but in a pinch, if you're looking to cut some corners, save a few pennies, yeah, it's always an option.
I think, oh, you mentioned that you were at the Big Ten Network and you saw their setup, right, for doing this with basketball?
Yeah.
That they would have production crews at the stadiums and then they would beam back the feed and they would have broadcasters in the Chicago studio. I think, I mean, it was happening with football before. It was happening more and more with some of the smaller games. I had heard, you know, ESPN was doing some of this, experimenting with remote broadcasts, which is, I mean, for on the broadcaster side, I'm sure they hate it. For the reasons Anish has already laid out, but knowing that you can save money and almost approximate a normal broadcast, I think we're going to see it way more. Maybe not in the near term. Maybe not, you know, we're going to see maybe the broadcasters get back in the stadium just because it's the healthy thing for broadcast crews and production crews. But I think long term, I think places are going to look, because it does cost a ton of money to send a crew and broadcast a game remotely from, it's not remotely, but from a stadium. I think we're going to see it much more. I really do.
And I think they will be able to apply what they've learned from 2020. They will further refine the tools to make this more readily available or a better product for the home viewer. They will find ways, if it involves saving money, to make the product sound 85% of what it normally would if the crew were there on site.
I mean, we have technology available already where you can just have a drone fix its sights on a specific, you know, on a raft or a dog and just follow it, right? We're not terribly far away from automated cameras following action. Maybe it'll be a couple years or something like that, but as technology gets better, technology is going to get cheaper. That's what always happens. And so I think it's definitely going to carry over, because what are we seeing more and more? That live sports are the one thing that people will pay to view as it happens. People aren't paying to watch dramas or comedies the second they premiere. They're, you know, cable subscriptions are down. But all of these networks are paying an astronomical amount of money. We just saw what ESPN, ABC pay for the SEC once their deal is up. And I think they're starting to broadcast it early. So the rights acquisition fees keep going up, are still through the roof for football especially. So on that back end, the networks are going to, sure, they're going to get some streaming money. They're going to get advertising revenue. But at the same time, they are going to look long and hard. Every single time one of these deals comes up and they're figuring out budgets, they're going to look long and hard at how they can broadcast a high-quality game at low-quality prices.
Thanks for listening to So Now What? Technical Difficulties Part 1. You can catch our full interview with Anish out on our Patreon at verballers.com. And don't forget to come back soon for part 2.